Maybe y'all come on in, take your shoes off, sit on down.
Y'all listening to
In the Corner, back by the woodpile.
Matthew Markham is one of those seemingly jack-of-all-trades, at least in the area of the performing arts. He sings, writes, and acts, often doing all at once. Matthew joined me back by the woodpile on a couple different occasions, bringing his big voice and thoughts with him.
Save me, Bill Sound. Beat up and found in the final round against another. I was pushed back by the rope slack, double-crossed heart attack of a boxing lover. Pow, zip, bam, I'm on the mats, man, lips bleeding, eyes blacked, man. But fighters don't shake hands, they only bump them gloves. Final count flat, man, 8 seconds on your back, man, somebody call a doctor, kind of love. Air pulled tight around me, smothered. Heart torn apart by an uppercut in a title match with a boxing lover. Pow, zip, bam, I'm on the mats, man. TKO, CPR, I can't even stand, man. 'Cause fighters don't shake hands, they only bump them gloves. Final count flat, man, 8 seconds on your back, man. Somebody call a doctor, kind of. Love. Keep your guard up. Zip, pop, bam. Keep your guard up. Zap, wop, slam. Keep your guard up. Pow, zip, bam. I'm on the mats, man. But I got a couple in that I won't take back, man. 'Cause fighters don't shake hands, they only bump them gloves. Final count flat, man, 8 seconds on your back, man. Somebody call a doctor, kind of love.
All right, so that's a song called Boxing Lover. I wrote that song a few years ago just as kind of a exploration of narrative and like melodic narrative. That's a term that I use to describe a lot of the stuff that I do because I'm a vocalist, but I'm also a spoken word poet. So in combining the two of them, I've coined this phrase called melodic narrative, and that was kind of one of my first, my first moments of embracing that kind of style was when I wrote that. And it was essentially, man, just an exercise of combining, you know, melody with a spoken word rhythm that wasn't musical at all.
Right.
So
it sounds very late 60s, early 70s.
Thanks, man.
I assume that you listen to that stuff.
I love that era. That's a huge influence with me, just as far as my songwriting and also my poetry and even you know, my narrative writing and my stories and that kind of thing. It stems from that kind of mindset where there was some kind of lyricism that was appreciated and. Yeah. You know, I love that vein of music and that genre of music.
Well, your daddy was a factory worker, working for the rich man and the rich man's change. Well, your daddy was a factory worker, rolling dice and dollars in a back alley game.
Yeah, Factory Worker is it's an Americana song, and it's a song that is, you know, it's a narrative, it's a vocal narrative. It tells a story about a child who was stolen from their parents by a rich couple, and you know, the life that the life and circumstances of the people that were involved in that scenario.
Is this a true story?
No. Oh. No, not true at all. Not based.
Made it up.
Yeah, not true. Not based on anything. Just a yarn, man.
Yeah.
Just a good tale. And a lot of my stuff, the majority, and I guess that's where I'm different from a lot of songwriters. Like, I feel like a lot of songwriters are very almost autobiographical, right, with their stuff, and obviously that like bleeds in, uh-huh, to my stuff sometimes as well. But I'm not one of these people that is autobiographical. So, uh-huh, you know, I'm kind of a storyteller. I like to tell a good story, and you know, it in some ways never applies to me whatsoever. Uh-huh. So I often wonder when people like hear my stuff, or if they hear like whatever, they must think that I've had this like crazy kind of existence, uh-huh, or whatever. But no, I just write about, you know, imaginary things all the time, you know.
So, do you think there's a danger in doing that?
I don't know. I mean, I think all great stories are great stories. Uh-huh. And I think if people, you know, it's like in, I feel like in music and in art and in anything expressive, when you're relating it to other people, people see what they want to see in it. And they see, you know, almost a reflection of themselves more so than, you know, than a, I don't know, like a portrait that you're trying to paint for them, you know. So I guess it's just how like the human brain receives information. You know, it's always in a personal realm. So if there is, you know, situations that, you know, people relate to, that they find in my work, I think that's wonderful. Even if I have never experienced them myself, you know. I think the goal of a storyteller is to tell a good story.
Might be a new girl in a new town, and I might fall in love, and I might settle down.
A Year or Two is, again, a song that I wrote with my long-term guitarist, a guy in Chicago named Eric Schreiber, who I can write a song with this kid in 10 minutes. Like, we've always been that way, and we've worked together, I guess, since 2004, so it's this very natural kind of groove that we get into. And A Year or Two, it was one of those, you know, it's one of those 10-minute songs, man, where you sit down, you write it in 10 minutes, and you're like, oh my God, it's done, and this is what it is. And it's turned out to be, it's one of the songs that I'm most proud of ever writing, and I think it is probably some of my best work, and we've got a really good response from it, so A Year or Two is about, you know, it's a heartbreak song, man. It's a tearjerker. It's about a relationship that that has ended, and you're saying in a year or two I'll get over you. Mm-hmm. You know, there'll be a new house. You know, I'll make some new friends. I'll fit right in. In a year or two I'll get over you.
Now, that sounds almost like your life in some ways, or is it made up?
Well, no. I mean, I've definitely had that relationship. Yeah. I will 110% say that. I definitely have had that relationship, okay, where it's like, in a year or two, I'm going to be so over you, you know? Yeah. So, yeah, that's a little more autobiographical,
yeah, okay,
I would say.
Sorry, you got me suspicious now.
Yeah.
You
got to figure out.
I'm not going to get emotionally invested if it's not true.
You got to figure out which ones are which.
Yeah, that song about the dog being ran over by the steamroller.
Oh, yeah, that's totally true.
Yeah, okay, good. Because I've already shed a couple of tears over that one.
And time passes slowly until you realize it's gone.
The song is The World's Strongest Man, and it was a song that I'd wrote in Chicago with a buddy of mine named Matt McDuffie, and it was a song that later, like a lot of my stuff, my music often finds itself in my performance pieces and stuff like that. So it was a song that initially was written with guitar and vocals, and then became a acapella song with a spoken word break in the middle.
Every day's a three-ring circus with trapezes and dancing girls.
painted faces and fire breathers. I juggle knives and swallow swords. And can you catch me? I think I'm falling. I might be flying, but I'm not sure. And there's no nets, no safety devices, only tied ropes and trapdoors. And maybe someone can ring the master, and if by chance he's not at home, leave him a message. Tell him the clowns have came to take the strong man home. And can you catch me? I think I'm falling. I might be flying, but I'm not sure. And there's no nets, no safety devices, only tied ropes and trapdoors.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the greatest show on earth. Standing before you is a man who only wears boxer shorts and will never ask you for directions. So skilled in the art of self-deceptions, he can't even begin to tell you how he truly feels. So, in an effort to show you no weakness and to never let you see him sweat, in an attempt to be a hunter, a gatherer, as well as a warrior, fully aware of the fact that real men don't cry and nice guys finish last, terrified of the titles of father, husband, son, brother, lover, significant other, because he feels as though he may never live up to any of those titles successfully. So, with a puffed up chest and a stern facial expression, hoping that when you look at him, you perceive him as being nothing less than calm, cool, and collected, he stands before you, silent.
Now if you want to take a picture with the world's strongest man, understand the weight that's on his shoulders that he has been carrying. And can you catch me? I think I'm falling. I might be flying, but I'm not sure. And there's no nets, no safety devices, only tied ropes and trapdoors. Only tied ropes and trapdoors.
World's Strongest Man, man. I think that is a. I think that's a song that is, or a piece rather. That's about all of us. I think we all adapt to these ideas of like what it is to be a man and what a man should do and how that should work in society and how we should be judged and appreciated and, you know, what our role should be. And I think the same way. I think it's the same way for women as well. And I think it's one of those things where, you know, I mean, not to be all like, you know, I don't know, beat a drum and shed a tear about it, but I think it is one of those things where, you know, men have feelings, we have feelings, it's a, you know, we can be vulnerable, we can be, you know, we can be afraid of things, and that is fine, and I feel like that doesn't make us less manly in any kind of way. I think that just makes us more human, so that's what that song is about.
Does this come from a real thing, where maybe you've had a girl that wanted you to man up more?
No, I actually wrote it from I wrote it for a conference in Chicago. I was asked to perform at this conference in Chicago that was exploring vulnerability.
Okay.
And my thesis work in college was like exploration of masculinity and male roles and that kind of thing.
Golden rings and a pocket full of drinks with a baby.
Okay, so you have a book coming out, and if I'm correct, it's basically a hodgepodge of different things like poetry, some scripts, right? And is there lyrics in there?
There's lyrics.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, usually books like this long come out after someone's died. So, is something going on with you that you want to tell us about?
No.
I'm totally fine. I just wanted to kind of get my work into a format where it's literary as well. Mm-hmm. It's called Noted, and collection of songs, stories, and scripts.
Mm-hmm. About the scripts, had these been performed before?
They have.
I've talked to a lot of script writers that, you know, often the stuff that finally gets performed is a whole lot different than what they had originally written. Did that happen with you? Was there a lot of changes made as it went to the stage?
There really wasn't, because I directed it as well. Okay. It was kind of one of those things where I could kind of control the, you know, control the outcome of it, and in a certain way. But I also had really great actors who, you know, once they had the material, they just did great things with it. So there wasn't a whole lot of, you know, I don't know what you would call it. There wasn't a whole lot
of shaping
that was really involved.
See, I can imagine if I was in your play, like bystander number three or something like that, that every day I would come to work and like bring you like a drink or like a pack of fresh boxers or something like that, and say, "Hey, can you write my role a little bigger?" Did any of that happen?
No, it didn't. I wish it would have, but I'm just...
Because you need some more boxers?
Right, because, well, I don't wear boxers, but, you know...
Yo!
Hey! But I would take the coffee and, you know, the cigarettes. Or...
This is a story called The Tale of a Goldfish. This is the tale of a goldfish, a fascinating creature. A living, breathing piece of art that is carefully displayed and then appreciated just for the sake of its nature. It has no cause or motive, it offers no logic or intention, it is simply scaled stimuli at its finest. It floats through life with a unique swagger and a fantastic pout, fawned over by audiences who come and go, watching intently while making weird faces. This is my goldfish. His name is Mick Jagger. I spent $60 on aquatic accoutrements at the local Petco and felt that my noncommittal tendencies would not be a factor in the lifespan of such an independent specimen. I brought him home in a plastic bag that I was careful not to poke or snag, and I was sure that we would have long talks and share subterranean secrets. He would carefully guard my car keys and my cigarette lighter due to his placement on my bookshelf. We would listen to Coltrane on vinyl, and I would never eat takeout alone again. I wondered if we might develop some telepathic bond that would last for infinity, and at his passing, I would be aggrieved as I reverently flushed him, whimpering, "He was my best friend." But none of this happened. In my self-indulgent attempt to be a really great pet owner, I fed him every time I walked past his bowl for the first part of the week. 3:20 on day 4, he was dead, floating there on his side, a beautiful purgatory fillet, a familiar fate of extravagant excesses that has often plagued his kind. I felt a distinct mix of exasperation and shame as my stomach began to sink, and the odor of putrid food and stale water rose to the occasion. I quickly grabbed a large soup spoon and scooped him out of his murk. I carried him diligently into the bathroom and dropped him into his porcelain memorial, flushing instinctively before any mustard attempt at a eulogy could be had. It all happened so fast, I thought. I didn't even have a chance to say goodbye. Gone were my great hopes of total companionship. Gone were my plans for interspecies bonding. Gone were my fantasies about gratuitous loyalty and shared wontons. As I returned to the scene of the crime, I noticed the kaleidoscope surface barrier of floating multicolored flakes that clung like an Italian widow to the bottom of the water at the top of the bowl. I thought this would be a fantastic tombstone. Here lies a goldfish that could only swim to the bottom of the top, a tragic victim of a liquid ceiling. I then proceeded to remove his micro pagoda and treasure chest before siphoning the stagnant water from the candy gravel that lined the bottom of his bowl. I dumped the water into the kitchen sink and thought that I could keep the bowl and gravel on display in some morbid attempt at decor. I returned to the aquatic crematorium, and just as I was beginning to unzip and heed the call of nature in a callous irreverence for the dead, what did I see swimming from the black hole that I was sure that led to nothingness but Mick Jagger, forging ahead like the Rolling Stones comeback tour at Wembley Stadium. Strutting and swaggering to center T-ball and then taking a victory lap as if to say, "I wasn't dead, mate. I was just messed up on the pink stuff." Amazing, I thought, re-zipping and hurrying into the kitchen to refill and replace everything necessary for a successful aquatic comeback. I grabbed the soup spoon and, like some mythical act of Neptune, whisked him safely back to his rightful place of drowned glory high above the relics of my efficiency studio apartment. This is the tale of a goldfish. What a fascinating creature.
And he's still alive?
Yeah, Mick is still alive.
Wow, that's really cool.
Uh-huh.
I was afraid at first that this was going to be a big deal.
Oh, no, dude. Mick is alive. I performed this. I performed that piece at the Winter Fringe Festival here in Nashville. And Mick made it on stage. He had his ball. He was beside him.
Yeah. So he joined you.
Yeah, he had his moment in the sun there. He loved it.
What did the reviewer say about the Goldfish's performance?
They were, I mean, it was 5 stars. Like, they were really impressed with him. I think they were more impressed with Mick than me. Because, you know, I mean, he was kind of playing for them, man. You know, swimming up, swimming around. He actually worked out really well with, like, the lights and stuff. I don't know what it was, but he was on fire that night. It's really true.
Great.
And it's winter in Davidson County, the snow that surrounds me is a sight to see. And I'm lonesome in Davidson County. Lord, I wish you were here with me.
Davidson County, we actually, as we record this, we're on the edge of Davidson County.
Yeah, absolutely.
I assume that that's autobiographical, right? Or there comes from something. Because you live here.
I live here now. Okay. I live here now, but I'm very happy here now. I didn't experience that I Miss You in Davidson County thing that the song is about. It's really weird.
Why did you choose the name then?
Well, David, I don't know. Actually, I was in my car, and I might still have it on my cell phone, but I was in my car, and I was in traffic, and I was driving, and it was winter in Davidson County, and thus, it's winter in Davidson County, and I sang this song into my phone while I was driving, and then...
Does that happen a lot?
Yeah, that's how most of it happens.
How many tickets have you gotten?
I've gotten a couple.
From writing novels.
I've gotten a couple, man. I'm a car writer, and I used to... Before, you know, I used to have the flip phone, man. I was sold on, like, the flip phone BlackBerry slider thing, and I didn't want to do the iPhone, and I was not getting into the Mac, but obviously I did.
Yeah.
And, you know, I used to pull over, and I would, like, write stuff down really quickly and then, you know, get back in my car. And now I just turn the phone on and sing into it. So it's, you know, it's a better method, I think. Cool. It's a little safer for everybody else involved.
You said you like it here?
Oh, I like it very much here. Yeah.
If a musician is hearing this, or somebody who's not a musician, how would you sell Nashville, Davidson County?
I love Nashville, first of all. I didn't really know what to expect from Nashville when I moved here. But it has, I don't know, there's a culture that exists in Nashville that is very not what you would think. I feel like a lot of people come to Nashville and they are very sold on the idea that it is the country music capital of the world, and there's nothing else that exists in Nashville except for that. I remember when we first moved here, I was behind a lady in the checkout line at, like, a food line or something like that. And it was literally my second night in town. And it is something I'll always remember from Nashville because it was so strange. I was behind this lady in the checkout line, and she had left her purse in her buggy, and she needed to run back and get some kind of groceries or whatever. And she turns around and she says to me, "Can you watch my purse? I have to run and get some, you know, some groceries or whatnot."
And, like,
and I was like,
I can watch it go into my car.
I was like, what, you know, like, what do you say to that? I was like, sure, I guess, you know, and I did, and, you know, no one took anything from it or anything like that, but, you know, I just thought that was the most bizarre thing in the entire world. Like, I mean, who does that? But, I mean, how wonderful it is that someone can do that. I mean, I don't know. Right, I guess. I have nice guy syndrome. I don't know.
So for Mother's Day this year, I recorded this, you know, this small collection of songs for my mom as a Mother's Day gift, right? I recorded it with my cousin in a little studio in Memphis. And, you know, her name is Rebecca Smith. She's a great songwriter, artist in her own right. And she kind of, acted as producer, and we really didn't know how we were going to do this or what we were going to do. So there's all of these old school gospel songs on it, man. Like we have Lord Don't Move That Mountain, and The Old Ship of Zion, and Bombing Gilead, and you know, these public domain gospel songs that have been around for years and years and years and years and years, and they're usually presented in this very very traditional way. And you know, the final product of what we come up with was, you know, just rearranging all of these old school gospel songs, and you know, putting them with new arrangement, and kind of giving them a update. And you know, I call 7 my hippie Christian album.
Lord, I don't bother nobody, I treat everybody the same, but every time I turn my back, they all be scandalizing my name. And when folks try to slay me, can they see that I'm trying? Yeah. Lord, don't move that mountain. Lord, don't move that mountain. Lord, don't move that mountain. Just give me strength to climb.
Great. Well, thank you for coming.
Hey, thank you for having me.
If people want to check out your music, how would you direct them?
You can go to www.matthewmarkhamofficial.com, and there's a Facebook link from there.
Okay, thank you much.
Yeah, thank you, man.
In the Corner, Back by the Woodpile podcast is produced by A Closet, A Pocket, and A Suitcase. You can email us at spuncounterguy@hotmail.com. And a special thanks to thebrofisticate.com.
Lord, don't move that mountain. Lord, don't move that mountain. Lord, don't move that mountain. Just give me strength.